films, was chosen by Lucas to helm Star Wars II at the suggestion of Gary Kurtz, and gave the film a sophisticated depth and an emphasis on characters and emotion, rather than action and special effects. A stylistic departure from Lucas and Star Wars, which sometimes led to resentment from the all-powerful executive producer. Lucas gritted his teeth as the director allowed actors to improvise and change lines to allow for a more believable performance, such as the carbon freezing scene, which Alan Arnold's book reveals was mostly improvised. And Kirshner often butted heads with Lucas on his policy on moving the film along as quickly as possible. Kirshner still thinks Empire Strikes Back moves too fast. Kirshner explained his involvement to Sound & Vision magazine.
"Why did Lucas choose me to direct? That's what 20th Century Fox wanted to know, because they thought I was too old. I was over 55. They said, get a young man. Get someone in their 30s, someone who will understand the kids. But George said no. He wanted me. George had been in my classes, my seminars at USC. I was teaching there on and off, and we became friends. Later, we would meet every once in a while, and he would talk about some of the films I'd done. Eyes of Laura Mars, The Return of a Man Called Horse, and The Flim Flam Man. He loved them. I want you to do the film, he said, because you know everything a Hollywood director's supposed to know, but you're not Hollywood. I turned it down. I told him I don't know anything about special effects. But he said you don't have to. You think up anything you want, and it's up to industrial light and magic to make it work. Now, I don't know of anyone else who could have said that, but he owns the company. So I'd ask for the most impossible shots, and they would do it.
Like his mentor Francis Coppola did for Apocalypse Now, Lucas had decided to finance the film himself to ensure personal profit and creative control. But even all the riches that Star Wars brought him were not enough to pay for the film. Lucas had quickly become a businessman and an entrepreneur, setting up multiple corporations to help him make his films. ILM had just moved out of its original building in Van Nuys into a more impressive lot in Marin County, a chaotic and expensive undertaking. And Lucasfilm and Star Wars Corporation were still being consolidated and managed by Lucas and his partners. He also began making plans for Skywalker Ranch, a filmmaking nexus where he could centralize all his resources, and so his lawyers began purchasing land in Marin County. A dream of his for years, it was his personal version of Coppola's American Zoetrope, where filmmakers could share resources outside the Hollywood system. The ranch would eventually cost nearly $20 million. Reinvesting all of his earnings from Star Wars back into his companies, Lucas was forced to secure a bank loan in order to complete the financial backing for Star Wars II. However, the production was plagued by many problems, which eventually led to the skyrocketing of its original budget. Lucas's fiscal problems only added to the pressures of making the second Star Wars film, and he was worried that the over-budget, behind-schedule movie, being directed overseas in England away from his watchful eye, would ruin him. All of his personal assets were tied to the production and invested in it. If the film was a flop, Lucas would be ruined. On one of his set visits, Lucas related to Alan Arnold the financial pressure he was under.
I'm faced with a situation where everything I own, everything I ever earned, is wrapped up in this picture. If it isn't a success, not only could I lose everything, but I could also be millions of dollars in debt, which would be very difficult to get out from under. It would probably take me the rest of my life just to get back even again. That worries me. Everybody says, oh, don't worry, the film will be a huge success, and I'm sure it will be. But if it is just one of those mildly successful film sequels, I'd lose everything. It has to be the biggest grossing sequel of all time just for me to break even.
Coppola was about to find out whether Apocalypse Now, debuting later that year, would sink or sail, and with it, his career. Lucas suddenly saw himself being reeled into the same filmmaking nightmare Coppola had been caught in for 3 years. The American New Wave had been steadily declining since Star Wars, due to big-budget flops such as William Friedkin's Sorcerer and Martin Scorsese's New York, New York. Star Trek The Motion Picture and The Black Hole had also recently been over-budgeted science fiction films with poor box office reception. And Lucas had just produced more American Graffiti, which was released later that year, and was not the success many had hoped. The footage Lucas saw in dailies and on his few set visits did not instill him with much confidence. Just as on the original film, Lucas suffered from anxiety because of the high-risk filmmaking. But it wasn't just Lucas who was affected by the production. The film took its toll on everyone. "It was the most wearing film I've ever done," associate producer Robert Watts once remembered. Filming would be delayed when Stanley Kubrick's The Shining accidentally burned down an entire stage, leaving 64 sets to be divided into 7 stages. In Norway, huge storms left the crew trapped in their hotel. Production designer and second unit director John Barry would unexpectedly die during production. Carrie Fisher would battle a heavy drug addiction, and every conceivable mechanical failure would occur. The film was more logistically complicated than anyone had anticipated, and a string of bad fortune, combined with Kirschner's desire to shoot the material slowly and methodically, resulted in massive management breakdowns. Kirschner remembered the troubled production in a Sound and Vision interview.
"When you're working on a film for almost 6 months, it was so difficult. Every shot was like pulling a donkey out of a hat. Because things didn't work, you had to make them work and improvise every time. Director François Truffaut said it better than I could. Something like, you start a film and you want to make the greatest one ever made. Halfway through, you just want to finish the damn thing. That's the way I felt. Halfway through, my crew was falling apart. Many of the people left. They were ill. So no, I never stopped and said, boy, oh boy, have we made a terrific film."
The production may have been more complicated than Lucas originally anticipated. Kirschner explained the madness of Empire Strikes Back to Star Wars Insider.
"George also came over once when I was shooting the X-Wing being pulled out of the water and moving across the swamp, based on the magic power of our little man. It had taken some time to set up, a few hours actually. And now we did the shot and the haze was right, because we had the set closed off so that you actually had clouds hanging. And then the ship came out of the water. It looked beautiful. And there was moss and seaweed, and the water is dripping off, and suddenly, the two wings just collapsed. I felt so badly for George, because I knew it was his money. I said, what happened? And they said, well, we didn't realize it wasn't waterproof, and all the wings are wood, and they couldn't take all the weight. I said, now you tell me. It took hours to rebuild it. They put in structural things and a little steel. 10 hours to do the shot, and it was maybe 6 seconds. But you know, when I came to the swamp set, it wasn't ready. So while they were working on one part of it, I'd start shooting another part. While we were lighting, they were banging away with hammers and pulling things in place. Also, people were sliding and slipping into the water, and we had a couple of broken arms. Sometimes I had to wear a gas mask because we had so much smoke pumped into the set, and I stood there for 12 hours a day, so I started getting ill. And they gave me a gas mask with a microphone inside so I could talk to everybody. It sounds like fun, but it wasn't. It was a hell of an experience, and it went on a long time, unfortunately. I once called George and said, George, it's taking a little longer than we thought. Do you want me to take some pages out of the script or, you know, what the hell can we do? And he said, don't do anything, just keep shooting. Those were his words. And that's, of course, the one thing you want to hear.
Mark Hamill recalled the pressure of making the film in a 1983 Starlog article. On the other hand, Empire seemed like 9 months of torture to me. I really got the stuffing kicked out of me in that movie. I'm supposed to be an actor, not a stuntman. And because of the mechanical problems with Yoda, I was the only human being listed on the call sheet for months. Everything else was puppets, props, and special effects. Overall, I probably had more differences of opinion with Kirsch. I liked his work, but he was an eccentric guy. I didn't find that to be a problem, but sometimes it was more difficult to get across what I was trying to say. He was very preoccupied, so I had to grab him by his collar and look him in the eyes to get his attention. Kirsch also changed his mind frequently, particularly with camera setups. For example, we would rehearse a setup for the next morning, but the odds were, by that time, the shot would change. Usually it would be a better shot, but if they had let him, he would have changed it again. Tension also began to build between Lucas and producer Gary Kurtz. Lucas was irritated with Kurtz for not restraining Kirschner. "The director needs to do what he needs to do, that's all," Kurtz says simply. But Lucas saw it differently.
"Gary never said no to anything."
In their daily telephone calls, he urged Kirschner and Kurtz to scale down and speed up. "George wasn't here," Kurtz noted in Mythmaker. "I was here. He was back there, working with ILM, getting the visual parts together. I kept telling George, 'Look, you've got to let me do this my way, because if you push him too hard, it'll just make things worse, not better. I've seen it. I've experienced it myself. What we're getting is very good. Don't make it worse than it is.'" Kirschner related his side of the balancing act between quality and quantity in this Star Wars Insider interview.
"In terms of just the logistics, George would have been much happier had I been able to shoot it faster. But frankly, to get what I was trying to get, I couldn't. I couldn't get the performances as well. I'll give you an example. We were shooting a very difficult scene with Harrison, and there was some special effects in the scene. We shot it in one take, and I said, 'That's it, we move on.' Harrison said, 'Wait, hold it. Tell me something, was I good, or did the special effects work, and therefore you don't want to shoot again?' I said, 'Harrison, by now you gotta trust me. You were great. The special effects happened to work, but you were great.' And he looked at me with that wonderful look of his. 'Uh-huh, okay,' he said, and he pointed his finger at me, wagging it, and he said, 'Now you better watch yourself. Because the temptation, if the special effects work, is to say, okay, the performance is good enough. Well, I couldn't get away with that with Harrison, and I didn't want to get away with anything with Mark, because I knew that it was important for him and for Carrie. So I'd have one eye on the special effects and one eye on my characters. And boy, they better come together, or else it didn't work.'"
The production, however, fell more and more behind schedule, while the budget escalated with each week. Eventually, disagreements between Lucas and Kurtz would lead to the two parting ways for the third installment, after being partners since American Graffiti. Lucas had been apprehensive about hiring Kurtz for Empire in the first place, feeling that Kurtz had aggravated the tensions on set during Star Wars, particularly with cameraman Gil Taylor. But at Kurtz's persuasion, he gave him a second chance.
"I suspected there would be problems, and I knew I was asking for trouble," Lucas later would say.
Kurtz was supposed to be Lucas's representative on the set, but in a sense, Kurtz betrayed him. He saw the film from Kirschner's point of view, agreeing that the film should be serious and slower, and was impressed with what they were able to achieve, allowing the schedule and budget to swell. Although some critics of Lucas have accused him of firing those who encouraged and challenged him creatively, and seeking more slavish yes-men producers for the rest of his career, Lucas's actions here were not wildly unreasonable. Kurtz let the production run massively over budget and weeks over schedule, which was all the more horrifying when one realizes that all of Lucas's future was tied up in the production. With Lucas's production responsibilities more as a manager, his department was an expensive failure. Kurtz, however, looked at it in a different light, confident that the film would return its monetary investment regardless of its increased expenditure, and felt that the quality of material was ultimately worth the budget crisis. Interviewed by IGN FilmForce, Kurtz said, "One of the arguments that I had with George about Empire was the fact that he felt in the end, he said, we could have made just as much money if the film hadn't been quite so good, and you hadn't spent so much time. And I said, but it was worth it." Perhaps there is a dichotomy here. Lucas would thankfully never run into the production, budget, or schedule problems of Empire, and yet he would never achieve the same level of critical and artistic success as he would eventually have with that film. Perhaps the reason that the film's producer and director were more concerned with its artistic quality than its mogul executive producer was because, as Lucas stated many times during the era, the Star Wars sequel's primary purpose was to provide him with funding for Skywalker Ranch, an investment Kirshner or Kurtz had little concern for.
"The ranch is the only thing that counts," Lucas told Lucasfilm president Charles Weber in 1980. "That's what everybody is working for."
With his hand in so many different ventures, Lucas only had so much attention to go around. He was managing his many companies and launching more, such as Pixar and the computer division, supervising the production of Empire, dealing with its troubled financing, building Skywalker Ranch, as well as planning other projects, such as Raiders of the Lost Ark. Star Wars was not his number one priority, and he didn't mind if it was merely good enough instead of the more idyllic aspirations that Kirshner and Kurtz were striving for.
"It looks pretty because Kirsch took a lot of time to do it," Lucas stated of Empire to Dale Pollack. "It's a great luxury that we really couldn't afford, and ultimately it doesn't make that much difference. It was just a lot better than I wanted to make it."
Meanwhile, once filming finished, the editing began another series of disasters. A rough cut had been assembled in 1979, and when Lucas screened it, he felt the same sense of panic and disappointment as he had at the disastrous rough cut screening of Star Wars.
"I was extremely upset because I felt it wasn't working at all," he told Dale Pollack. "Here I was, way over budget, running out of money, and I had a movie I thought was no good."
Pollack provided an account of how tense the situation got, as Lucas scrambled to save the movie by recutting it himself. Lucas's revised version was heavily criticized by Kirshner, editor Paul Hirsch, and Kurtz. "A lot of it didn't work, and some of it was cut too fast," Kirshner says. Lucas finally lost his temper. Dwayne Dunham, who accompanied George, sat in amazement as his boss exploded. "You guys are ruining my picture. You are here messing around and we're trying to save this thing." Kirsch calmly pointed out what he thought Lucas had done wrong, but George became even more upset. "It's my money, it's my film, and I'm going to do it the way I want to do it," he declared. Lucas soon reconsidered once he had calmed himself. The stress of the film had taken its toll, and now finally it ruptured out.
"I never got on Kirsch about the fact that he was over schedule and putting a great burden on me in my life," Lucas admits. "Everything I owned was wrapped up in that damn movie. If he blew it, I lost everything." "But they were right," he told Dale Pollack. "It didn't really work very well. That was what made me angry. I couldn't make it work."
Kirshner suggested some changes, and Lucas recut the film following his advice.
"It came together beautifully," he says.
However, even as personal differences began to subside, the budget continued to escalate and required a second bank loan, which also went over budget, requiring a third loan, which would only be given if 20th Century Fox would step in to guarantee it, leading to an improved distribution deal on their part.
"We're still suffering from it," Lucas lamented in 1983.
What had started as a $15 million budget had more than doubled to $33 million when all was said and done. Coppola's Apocalypse Now had been released the year before. The film was a critical hit and managed to take in over $100 million, Cannes Palme d'Or, and two Oscars. His younger protege awaited to see if he would have as much luck. But for all of Lucas's worries and troubles, Empire Strikes Back was an enormous hit when it was released to much fanfare on May 21, 1980. A decidedly darker and more sophisticated continuation of the story, it was the complete opposite of what everyone expected from a Star Wars sequel, and ended on a cliffhanger that guaranteed more films to resolve all of the shocking plot developments that had been left open. The budget and schedule problems turned out to give the film the care and attention to subtleties that make it considered the best of the series. And the emotional depth and deliberate pacing that Lucas loathed about Kirschner's style would become the fan-favorite film's most enduring strength.
"It has to be slower and more lyrical," Kirschner explained of his method. "The themes have to be more interior, and you don't have a grand climax."
But Lucas still seemed to harbor some resentment for all the grief he went through.
"I appreciated what Kirsch was trying to do, and I sympathized with his problems. The film was well directed. It was just differently directed."
But even Lawrence Kasdan, who objected like Lucas to the on-set improvisations, admitted that the film's unique style stems from the perfectionist director.
"It has a quality I think Kirsch gave it. It's just not like any of the others. I really loved Richard Marquand, but he didn't put as distinctive a stamp. But I think Kirsch just directed Empire great. He loosened up George in a lot of ways. George wanted the movie to be his, the way he wanted, but he knew how to use Kirsch and trust him, even though it scared George at times."
The Washington Post raved, "Empire turns out to be a stunning successor, a tense and pictorially dazzling science fiction chase melodrama that sustains 2 hours of elaborate adventure while sneaking up on you emotionally." There were, however, some who criticized the film, and it inevitably had a divided release. Many felt the film lacked the warmth and heart of the original film, and were put off by the lack of a proper introduction or resolution to the story. In spite of some criticism, however, the film was an all-out success, taking in a massive $209 million at the box office. In the Wake of Empire. But by 1980, Lucas had been irrevocably changed. He was literally working himself to death, trying to control not only a disastrous major motion picture in which was wrapped his personal fortune, but also a growing corporation with many subsidiaries. I don't know how one person has that much energy, production coordinator Mickey Herman once observed of Lucas's exhausting efforts. His marriage was beginning to grow strained. His company was developing out of control, leading to massive layoffs as he downsized. And he suffered from chronic headaches and bouts of dizziness, eventually being diagnosed with an ulcer that year. Only 7 more Star Wars films to go. The behind-the-scenes workings of those eventful years changed the Star Wars story more than anyone realizes. Even before the troubled second film was released, Lucas had begun to reconsider his elaborate plans for the series as the realities of shooting set in. If he was to go along with his epic of 9 films, he still had roughly 20 more years of straight filming ahead of him. After all that he had gone through, first on Star Wars and then again on Empire Strikes Back, it is unlikely that he was looking forward to 7 more of those experiences. Making Star Wars 2 was not the fun romp he had envisioned in 1977. And in fact, the third installment would be done under mostly obligatory conditions.
"I was ready to quit after Star Wars," Lucas reflected in an interview with Denise Worrell. "I wanted to quit then, but I kidded myself into thinking that if I stopped directing, it would be like quitting. I thought I could just oversee it, but it didn't work that way.
The decision Lucas began considering was a fairly obvious consequence of such strife. Was it really necessary to extend the series beyond Star Wars 3? A vague series of sequels, which Lucas only added to the story because he could, suddenly began to look like an unnecessary chore, and starting over from scratch on a series of prequels was no less difficult. Before Empire Strikes Back was finished, Gary Kurtz even claimed that Lucas's plan for the third film was shifting.
At that time, during the making of Empire Strikes Back, we were still talking about what was happening with Jedi. And it already was apparent that he was changing his mind with what he wanted to do with Jedi.
Not only were Lucas's plans for the story changed by Empire's making, but also his plans for its execution. Star Wars was supposed to be a collaborative series, one in which Lucas himself had only a delicate influence, where he would step away and a new director would steer the story and style of each film. Every few years, a new director would make a Star Wars film, putting a slightly different spin on each movie. In this, Irvin Kershner was the only one who was allowed the privilege of playing in Lucas's world, of making it and adapting it into his own. After the personal disaster that was The Empire Strikes Back, Lucas withdrew this plan and spun 180 degrees for the final sequel. He would choose a director more in line with his own style, be on set every single day, film much of the material himself, and for all intents and purposes become a co-director. This shift was encouraged by the fact that the series had strayed from the disconnected Adventure of the Week style of 1977, which Kershner had been hired under, to a more epic, connected saga, with a pre-planned story arc and stylistic continuity. By the time of Empire's release, Lucas had become somewhat disillusioned with the series, and his personal life also was feeling the consequences of such laborious work. George and Marcia's already strained marriage was in worse shape than ever, and Marcia wanted to start a family, as did George, but as long as he was working on Star Wars, he knew he would never have enough time to properly raise a child. Their marriage would sadly not last the release of the final Star Wars film 3 years later. Another separation would occur with Lucas immediately following Empire's wrap, this one with Gary Kurtz. With irreconcilable differences over what had happened during Empire and over where the series was headed, the two parted ways. Kurtz reflects on the split in an interview 20 years later with Film Threat. Film Threat. So when did you and George Lucas start to not see things the same way? What was the beginning of it? Kurtz.
I think that was during the making of Empire. George got really concerned about how long we were taking. We didn't go over budget, and he banged me for the cost overruns on Empire.
Film Threat.
And taking Irvin Kershner's side.
Kurtz.
And taking Irv's side, yeah. It was kind of a mutual parting. It wasn't acrimonious, it was just that he felt he would probably be more comfortable with someone else to handle the production chores on Jedi, and I felt that I would prefer a different kind of challenge, that wasn't kind of repeating something I had already done. Jim Henson had asked me to produce The Dark Crystal, something he had been working on for about 10 years.
Kurtz also began to loathe the growing Lucasfilm empire. What was once a modest company run by Lucas, Kurtz, Marcia, a bookkeeper, Lucy Wilson, and a secretary, Kurtz's sister-in-law, Bunny Alsop, had since grown into a sprawling empire, symbolized by Fortress Lucas, the under-construction Skywalker Ranch, perhaps the inspiration for the under-construction Death Star that Lucas would write a few months later. Lucas himself was becoming more and more isolated from the real world, with fame catapulting him into such stratospheres of celebrity that he no longer could live and work like a normal human being.
"People can be pests," Lucas commented at the time. "Everyone wants to be my friend now, and they all want something. I don't want any more friends."
Looking back, Kurtz mused to John Baxter,
The saddest thing about watching that process was the slow takeover by the bureaucracy. With that, slowly came this thing about dress code, company policy, and nobody talking to press, and a firm of PR people, and it was quite frustrating, really. I was there longer than anybody, and had been with him for the longest period of time, and I just felt that I didn't like it. The bureaucracy grew and grew. You couldn't talk to George. You had to talk to his assistant. It became more Howard Hughes in a way. I decided I was more interested in working on interesting films than in being tied to a machine like that. Lucas had blamed Kurtz for the cost overruns on Empire, but by 1983 accepted responsibility.
Gary did the best job he could. He made enormous contributions, but he was in over his head, Lucas told Dale Pollack. If anybody is to blame, it's me, because I was the one who knew and stayed over here in California until it was too late.
Lucas would turn to Howard Kazanjian, a friend from his days at USC who had produced the flop sequel More American Graffiti in 1979, and who was also currently producing Raiders of the Lost Ark to manage the third Star Wars film. While Raiders of the Lost Ark was being filmed in July 1980, Lucas was readying to work on Star Wars 3. During this time, Lucas undoubtedly was weighing the future of the saga. The truth was that everyone was beginning to tire of the films. In fact, Harrison Ford fought hard to see to it that his character not return for the third installment, and instead be killed off. Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher had since been typecast in their respective roles, with their likenesses emblazoned on everything from t-shirts to coffee mugs to action figures. Rabid Star Wars fans would swarm them in the streets, and the only way many of the actors could find work was when it was reprising their Star Wars characters, such as on The Muppet Show or the Star Wars Holiday Special. The actors were under contract for only one more film, and though Lucas had at one time hoped to include them in additional films, he may have realized that not even he would be up to the task of doing more than three. Meanwhile, Marcia hounded George to step back and settle down for a while before their relationship crumbled any more. He had been working round the clock since 1976. It appears Lucas took his wife's advice. Although he had previously refused to start a family because his Star Wars trilogy was all-consuming in his life, he and Marcia would soon adopt a baby girl, Amanda, in 1981, after Lucas decided to give up his space opera. With Revenge of the Jedi poised to end the conflict begun in the first film, the Empire defeated, Darth Vader dead, Luke a Jedi, and the heroes victorious, there was little need to extend the story beyond this. Of course, one vestige of the sequel trilogy remained in the form of the other that was mentioned, and now needed to be addressed. But with some clever writing, it could be resolved and the series finished. It seems Lucas's generation-spanning 9-film epic was dead before it ever got off the ground. Just 2 short years after he mapped out a 9-film structure, he was ending it. The public world was still waiting on the edge of their seats to find out what happens to the heroes and villains of Star Wars. Was Vader lying to Luke? Was Obi-Wan lying to Luke? Could Luke go to the dark side? Would Han be saved? Was Luke still in love with Leia? And just who was the other that Yoda refers to? Lucas may have been wondering some of the same things, since so much of his story was up in the air. Speculation was abound by the public and the press. Mark Hamill offered some amusing speculation in a 1980 Starlog article. David Packer wrote, George insisted the other had always been part of the storyline, though he never told me who it might be. Somebody suggested it might be the princess, but I think that would be a letdown. Judging from Hamill's remarks here and other things he has said, it seems likely that the story has a life of its own anyway, and not even George Lucas knows for sure how it will emerge until it is down on paper and then on film. I remember very early on asking who my parents were and being told that my father and Obi-Wan met Vader on the edge of a volcano and they had a duel. Now I wonder if it's true. I mean, there are so many things. For example, remember the Clone Wars? They could have cloned my father. But changes are inevitable, he continues. And Darth Vader is a good example of changing a character to please the people. I think originally, if you follow classic drama, I would have to kill him in the third episode. But now he's a cult figure, and in a way, George may not want to do away with him, Hamill confides. Ultimately, the Emperor should be the main bad guy, someone you try to get through 9 movies, and in the 9th one you succeed. There has got to be something to the fact that he looks and sounds a bit like Obi-Wan. There were many possibilities to where the story could be headed. One last fact of significance from Empire Strikes Back is the premiere of the episode listing. When Empire Strikes Back was released, the opening titles proclaimed, to the confusion of most audience members, Star Wars Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back. Following on the change that appeared in the public version, as it was officially designated, of the script which appeared in The Art of Star Wars, an alternate title card was filmed for Star Wars. When Star Wars was re-released the following year in 1981, the updated titles now read Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope. The Washington Post reported in 1980, "The first indication of unexpected developments comes almost immediately. It is the appearance of the heading Episode 5 at the top of a prologue that crawls from the bottom to the top of the screen. Could one Star Wars plus one Empire Strikes Back equal 5? When Star Wars is reissued, probably next summer, the prints will include the subtitle Episode 4, A New Hope. This adjustment may already be seen in the published screenplay, which came out last winter in an attractive book called The Art of Star Wars. The missing 3 episodes that begin the saga, of course, came into existence once Lucas developed the backstory to Obi-Wan and Father Skywalker, in which the latter falls to the dark side and becomes Darth Vader, back in 1978, as already covered. This began the first of 2 main events that would lead to the formation of the prequel trilogy. It provided the basis for the creation of the story, but another event would shape and mold the focus of that story. But its effect would not come to pass for over an entire decade. That event is what we now come to, when George Lucas altered his plans for the saga and ended the series on Episode 6. This is, of course, the humanization and redemption of Darth Vader, and the creation of Anakin Skywalker, the fallen hero. Chapter 7. Demons and Angels. With the final chapter of the story looming, Lucas now had to bring the series to a satisfactory close, while resolving all the subplots set up in the previous film. The main one, the one which everyone who had seen Empire was looking forward to with anticipation, was the resolution to Vader's shocking line, "I am your father." Because of this, the story would ultimately shift to one in which a son must confront his father, a plot point which had not necessarily been planned upon as being so significant, but was now thrust into Lucas's writing out of necessity. This unexpected turn would become one of the most important events in the creation of the saga. Because the shocker of "I am your father" was so momentous, Lucas had no room to develop the series beyond this plot point, and instead, Star Wars 3 would become about Darth Vader and his relationship with his son. It would become, inevitably, about Vader's redemption, and thus forever change the series. As noted before, all indication is that Vader was not initially supposed to be redeemed, at least not in the manner in which the eventual film played out. His return to the light side and the emphasis placed on him would be natural developments that came out of the story as it was written draft by draft. Although the notion of him confronting his Jedi past was likely in place as a possible story thread, ever since Lucas began thinking about future episodes after writing Draft 2 of Empire Strikes Back. Lucas said in a 1980 Rolling Stone interview,
"In the next film, everything gets resolved one way or the other. Luke won the first battle in the first film. Vader won the second battle in the second film. And in the third film, only one of them walks away. We have to go back to the beginning to find out the real problem."
The exploration of Vader's humanity is first hinted at, as Lucas seems to be implying that going back to the beginning, in other words, to Vader's fall from grace, is where the real heart of the conflict lies. Prior, even in the 9-film version of the story, Vader's humanity would have likely been explored. Making him into Luke's father had humanized him enough, and with issues of temptation and betrayal at hand, and the notion that Vader was once a hero, it would be natural to bring forth these issues at some point. However, it seems that as the newly created story point surrounding Father Vader soaked into his mind, he began to develop the idea of Vader and Luke confronting each other as father and son, and not enemies. A story point which can be seen in its early stages, with Vader's invitation to Luke to join him and overthrow the Emperor at the end of Empire Strikes Back. The rough draft of Revenge of the Jedi resumed this thread, but with a more humanized and personalized version of Vader. It was this seed that would soon grow into the redemptive savior version that we are familiar with, the tragic hero of the final draft. Gary Kurtz told Film Threat of similar story development that never came to complete fruition, but rather transformed.
The one story thread that got totally tossed out the window for Jedi, which was really pretty important, I think, was the one of Vader trying to convince Luke to join him to overthrow the Emperor, that together they had enough power that they could do that. And it wasn't him saying, "I want to take over the world and be the evil leader." It was that transition. It was Vader saying, "I'm looking again at what I've done and where my life has gone and who I've served," and very much in the samurai tradition, and saying, "If I can join forces with my son, who is just as strong as I am, then maybe we can make some amends." So there was all of that going on in Jedi as well. That was supposed to go on.
Vader's redemption was not the compassionate one of salvation seen in the final film, but rather a redemption based on loyalty and honor. It was, as Kurtz points out, very much a samurai tradition, and this precise point stems from the character of Prince Valorum in the 1974 rough draft of Star Wars, who was an adaptation of a samurai character from The Hidden Fortress, General Tadokoro. Lucas first mentioned the film's title in a conversation with Alan Arnold in 1979, and in May 1980, just as The Empire Strikes Back was hitting theaters, the third film was officially announced. Star Wars III would be known as Revenge of the Jedi. Reports Banthatrax, "Now that The Empire Strikes Back has been completed, Lucasfilm Limited is preparing work on the third film in the Star Wars saga, to be called Revenge of the Jedi. Pre-production will begin in January of 1981, and the film is tentatively scheduled for release during the spring of 1983. However, when Lucas began to actually flesh out the story, it ended up subtly changing. In its initial conception, it was about the heroes fighting back after their defeat, and Luke's ultimate triumph as a Jedi. The triumph of good over evil in the destruction of Vader and the Empire. But when Vader and his redemption became the eventual focus of the film, the story ceased to be centered on vengeance and instead revolved around deliverance, leading to a controversial last-minute title change to be discussed later. In July of 1981, just after the revised rough draft was written, Kerry O'Quinn asked Lucas if he had the 9-film series already plotted, to which Lucas replied,
"Yeah, but it's a long way from the plot to the script. I've just gone through that with Revenge of the Jedi, and what seems like a great idea when it's described in 3 sentences suddenly doesn't hold together when you try to make 5 or 6 scenes out of it. So plots change a lot when they start getting into script form."
Reaching for the future. Before Lucas sat down in his writing office, Raiders of the Lost Ark had to be filmed,
I probably had more fun on that picture than any other, Lucas said to Dale Pollack. I didn't have to do anything but hang out. I had all the confidence in the world in Steve Spielberg, and I was not at risk financially.
With Raiders of the Lost Ark, Lucas finally had a chance to institute the James Bond-style adventures that he had dropped during the development of Empire Strikes Back. Not surprisingly, he only had the concept itself of doing sequels and not actual stories. In fact, as Spielberg recounted the making of the Raiders sequels in a 2003 interview, it is remarkably similar to the process of scripting the Star Wars sequels. When George and I were in Hawaii and I agreed to direct Raiders, George said that if I did wind up directing the first one, that I would need to direct three of them. He said he had three stories in mind. It turned out George did not have three stories in mind. We had to make up all the subsequent stories. Raiders of the Lost Ark was too super packed with gags and stunts and set pieces. No movie could hold that much. So certain things carried over, and I always remember the river rafting scene which we had written for Raiders, which I saved and kind of bookmarked for another Raiders movie. That went into Temple of Doom. And then we had an entire minecart chase, like a roller coaster ride. That was originally written for Raiders, and so I basically just took it out of Raiders and kept it in a drawer. And then when it came time to figure out set pieces for Temple of Doom, we dusted it off and stuck in the end. Raiders of the Lost Ark was a massive hit, and Lucas already had sequels planned before the film was even released. As Star Wars was ending, another franchise was beginning. The smashing success of Raiders has been said to have changed much of the direction of the future Star Wars films.
This idea that the roller coaster ride was all the audience was interested in, said Kurtz, and the story doesn't have to be very adult or interesting, seemed to come up because of what happened with Raiders of the Lost Ark and the Indiana Jones films, and the fact that that seemed to make a lot of money.
Star Wars, by the end of its first theatrical run, had domestically grossed $307 million. Rejecting the conventional approach to sequels, Lucas ultimately made a follow-up that wasn't at all like the original, being darker, more adult, and introspective. Kids, understandably, were not as enamored by it as they were with Star Wars, nor were critics, and Empire Strikes Back domestically grossed $209 million, a full $100 million less than the original. Lucas returned to the light-hearted, more accessible, action-packed roots with Raiders. Raiders would become a bigger hit than Empire ever was, with audiences and critics alike, especially those youngsters who had first experienced Star Wars, and without any built-in audience, managed to inch past the $200 million mark. There was a clear message that the younger audiences had been alienated by the darker themes of Empire. Indeed, Empire is often the least favored of children, but most favored of adults, while Jedi would inevitably be the most favored of children, but least favored of adults. Perhaps this explains the more kid-friendly turn in the third film. While the only puppet in Empire had been a grumpy Buddhist philosopher, Jedi would give kids an entire palace full of zany Muppets, including a brief musical number, and a whole planet full of teddy bears. Lucas's instincts paid off. The film would prove to be a whopping $50 million more successful than its predecessor. Lucas had made bold choices to ignore conventional sequel rules, but Empire's stunning disengagement in style from the original film was almost entirely due to Irvin Kershner and Lawrence Kasdan, who shaped the material to be a serious adult fantasy film with an emphasis on character. Lucas argued in story conferences that the film had to be faster, less developed, more focused on action, more like an adventure serial. But ultimately, Kershner took the film away from Lucas, and Kasdan was on the same page as Kershner.
I thought the movies could hold more character and more complexity, Kasdan said in Mythmaker. George thought they should be simpler in another way. It was a serious philosophical difference.
In script form, it was not quite the way Lucas wanted it, but once filming commenced, Kershner put even more emphasis on the interior, on character motivation and introspective visual lyricism. and it horrified Lucas. For someone as powerful as Lucas, he should have been able to put his foot down and stop this, and that's why he had Gary Kurtz on set. But Kurtz was on the same side as Kirschner, and fought Lucas about the same issues as he did, feeling that the film should be slower and more serious, and that the extra money being spent was ultimately worth it. Lucas, of course, did not agree, and with only a limited emotional investment in the franchise, he became infamous for saying, "It's good enough." Kurtz explained to IGN Filmforce.
"I think that he did chafe a bit under the idea of someone saying that's not a good idea some of the time. At the very end of Empire, we decided that there had to be an extra shot at the very end to identify this rebel fleet. If you remember how the end works, it's before you go into the medical department, who are working on Mark's hand. It's the establishing shot of the fleet. They weren't very difficult to do, and all the ships were there. Just pile up the composites, and they were rushed through just to get it done. Very last minute. One of them wasn't particularly good, and George said, 'Oh, well, maybe we should just let it go.' I said, 'It's worth at least one more go-through. One bad shot can ruin the whole movie, basically.'" Lucas tried to take back the film once filming was over, re-editing it to be fast and action-oriented like he envisioned. But it was a complete disaster because it simply wasn't the way the material was shot. Although many find the film to be a superior artistic endeavor, Lucas admits that he wasn't concerned with making it as such. He was more interested in producing a product that would appeal to kids and finance his other ventures. It is important to understand that he truly did care about the sequels and was very protective of the galaxy he had created, but it wasn't the be-all, end-all creation that some may see it as today. It was a product that Lucas intended to use to finance the projects that he truly had his heart set on, namely Skywalker Ranch and the personal films that he would develop out of the facility. That was his goal, to make an independent filmmaking empire, not to make Star Wars sequels. The filmmaker's community center, as he described it at the time, cost more money than he had, which is why he intended to use the Star Wars sequels to make him box office green. Commercialism took precedence over the actual content, though he very much was still concerned about that as well, just in a more casual, producer-like manner.
"The idea for The Ranch came out of film school," Lucas explained to Rolling Stone in 1980. "It was a great environment. A lot of people exchanging ideas, watching movies, helping each other out. I wondered why we couldn't have a professional environment like that." He made a small-scale version of this with his Park House office in the 1970s, where he rented rooms out to other filmmakers, and they all shared ideas and worked together. Now he was attempting to construct this in much grander proportions, the ones originally envisioned for Zoetrope.
"I figure it will take between 5 and 6 years and cost in excess of $20 million, he continued. "That's way beyond my personal resources."
Indeed it was, as Lucas estimated at that time that his personal net worth was somewhere around $20 million, much of which he had invested into purchasing the real estate for the ranch, which was why he couldn't personally finance Empire Strikes Back himself, but had to instead go through bank loans. Realizing such an elaborate facility was something only oil tycoons could do, and though Lucas was rich, he wasn't rich enough, so he had to devise an investment scheme. While dumping his personal fortune into the real estate, the sure-to-be-lucrative Star Wars sequel would be financed by a bank, and then the huge box office return would both pay off the bank's initial investment as well as provide Lucas with the additional funds required to build the ranch, with additional sequels and merchandising keeping the facility in business. If, however, Empire failed to cover its overhead, which was much more than $30 million when you account for advertising, distribution, and other costs, then the bank would own the film, Lucas would be millions of dollars in personal debt, and the dream of running an independent filmmaking empire would be impossible, with him instead forced to sell the $30 million Lucasfilm Corporation and indebted to make more commercial projects to keep himself afloat. Perhaps now the financial tunnel vision that Lucas expressed in 1979 is made clearer. Empire had to be hugely successful for him not only to repay the bank, give Fox their share of gross, finance the many companies and subsidiaries, and make some personal profit, but it also had to bring him an additional $20 million personally if he were to pay for the research facility, which was his chief goal. Although the film probably would have done this regardless of how good or bad it was, Lucas's obsession with making it commercial and low cost is not hard to understand, nor is his paranoia of failure, especially when the sequel to Graffiti, presumed to be a guaranteed hit, performed poorly at the box office, warning Lucas that nothing was guaranteed. Lucasfilm ILM and The Ranch would also need a steady supply of funds once they were set up to pay for the enormous overhead that they would generate every year. At the time of Empire, Lucas envisioned a steady stream of Star Wars sequels to keep him in business. He said on an Empire Strikes Back set visit in 1979,
"Most of this filmmaking effort is so I can create a dream I've had for a long time, which is to build a research retreat for film. The amount of money needed to develop a facility like that is so enormous that the money I have doesn't amount to anything. You need millions and millions of dollars to build such an operation. The only way I can do it is to create a company that will generate profits. The Star Wars films are the core of Lucasfilm, which is why I have to concentrate on them. I don't want to spend the rest of my life making Star Wars pictures, but I do want to get them set up so that they'll operate properly without my having to get completely involved in all of them. They've got to be self-generating to support the facility."
But by the completion of that film, forces in his personal life had compelled him to diminish his reach. His marriage was on the rocks, and the Lucases had decided they would say goodbye to Star Wars and adopt a child, which they did in 1981. Ridding himself of his burdensome aspirations of imperialism, Revenge of the Jedi nonetheless remained as a final attempt at creating his facility. With the land already purchased and the buildings under construction in anticipation of the returns of Empire Strikes Back, Jedi was his ace in the hole that could potentially pay it all off. Lucas talked about his plan in a 1980 interview. Lucas:
"We are taking the profits from The Empire Strikes Back and the next film, Revenge of the Jedi, and investing them in outside companies, then using those profits to build the ranch and maintain the overhead."
Gene Vallely: "What happens if the Empire doesn't make enough money for your ranch?" Lucas:
"Well, if it doesn't happen with this one and the next, then that's the end. I'm not going to spend the next 15 years of my life trying to make hit movies to get the ranch."
Thus, it was highly important that Revenge of the Jedi be made his way, and that the struggles with the director not reoccur, that Jedi be constructed as a hit movie so that Lucas could finally get the ranch, as he explained above. And Lucas got his wish. Empire was a huge success to his relief, and it helped make the first payment for the construction of the high-tech facility itself, which was helped along the way by additional income from Star Wars merchandising, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and finally Return of the Jedi when it was released. Unexpectedly, however, the dream would crumble before Lucas's eyes, but we will come to that in the next chapter. Thanks to the profit from Empire, Skywalker Ranch was beginning construction just as Lucas was readying to work on the third Star Wars film. Dale Pollack described it in 1983 as it was undergoing its final phases of development. Skywalker Ranch promised to fulfill many of Lucas's long-standing goals. It would give him a headquarters unlike that of any other movie company. It would be a motion picture think tank, where movies would be conceptualized rather than physically made. It would be neither a film studio nor a film campus, but something in between. Eventually, it would become home to Lucas's many future companies: Lucasfilm, Industrial Light and Magic, Skywalker Sound, and more. A complete reorganization of Lucasfilm was needed in order to both secure the impending move to the ranch and to regain control of the company into Lucas's hands. Under the successful leadership of President Charles Weber, The company had grown out of control and threatened to become the very corporate entity Lucas despised. In the end, Weber was fired, and in the move to Skywalker Ranch, nearly half of Lucasfilm's employees were laid off. Lucas gave them all 6 months to find new jobs and vocational counselors to help them, as well as generous cash settlements. With all of this business drama occurring, it was clear that Star Wars was no longer Lucas's number one priority. He had since moved on to other things and saw his primary responsibility as the head of his enterprises and as a founding father in a new independent filmmaking horizon. A return to writing. Perhaps because of all of this, it wasn't until February 20th, 1981, that Lucas finally completed the handwritten rough draft of Revenge of the Jedi. The story had to be epic in scope, yet personal in its conflicts. A grandiose, spectacular climax had to occur against the personal relationships of the characters. There were a lot of loose ends that needed to be quickly tied up, and the public expected a spectacular ending to the trilogy.
"The series started out as a simple fairy tale, and that's all it really is," Lucas said in 1981. "It's really a little bit more controlled than you might think. When Revenge comes out, people will say, 'Oh my God, how obvious. Why couldn't they think of something more interesting than that?'"
Lucas had brainstormed a vague arc for the two sequels around the time he had written the third or fourth draft of Star Wars, but this brief outline, Luke begins training as a Jedi under Obi-Wan's tutelage, the rebels relocate to a new base and continue their battle, and Luke confronts Darth Vader, had basically been funneled into Empire Strikes Back, leaving very little story for the third film, other than a concluding grand climax that finally resolved the conflicts. As such, the story was stretched thin, as Lucas admitted. All that was actually needed was a final confrontation between Luke and Darth, and the concluding battle between rebels and Empire, with Leia and Han's romance finally culminating and the Emperor destroyed. Because of this, the majority of the actual plot had to be recycled. Lucas turned the capture of Han Solo into a lengthy action sequence that returned to Tatooine and one-upped the creatures seen in the cantina, reused the Wookiee subplot from the 1974 rough draft as a race of primitive forest creatures called Ewoks that battle the Empire, and recycled the Death Star attack in a sequence with more advanced special effects, and with not one, but two Death Stars in the initial drafts.
"There were a lot of things that were added into this one because of the fact that by the time I got down this far from the original outline, the story had become pretty thin, and I had to fill in a lot of blanks," Lucas admitted in 2004's DVD commentary. "This whole sequence with Jabba the Hutt was more an afterthought than anything else, because Han Solo had become such a popular character."
Gary Kurtz argued that these newly added elements cumulatively diluted the power of what he maintains was originally to be a more mature and sophisticated plot that was not as convoluted as these additions made it, especially once Leia was also written in as Luke's sister.
"The idea of another attack on another Death Star wasn't there at all," Kurtz says. "It was a rehash of Star Wars with better visual effects. And there were no Ewoks. It was just entirely different. It was much more adult and straightforward, the story."
Denise Worrell described Lucas's writing environment as he sat down with a pencil and stack of paper in early 1981. Lucas's writing room is what Marcia calls a treehouse environment, which used to serve as their mansion's carriage house. Marcia decorated the suite of rooms, a writing nook and desk built into a windowed wall a few steps up from a large living room, a bathroom, and a tiny kitchen, with redwood paneling and forest green fabrics. As you enter, there is a green couch in front of a fireplace and a stack of wood. There are bookshelves around the room and a TV and stereo system on one wall. The carpet is beige. Lucas's desk is stained redwood, and on it are a Mickey Mouse phone, a Wookiee pencil holder, a telescope, and several books. Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces, Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, Webster's Dictionary, Harper's Bible Dictionary, The Foundations of Screenwriting by Sid Field, and Roget's Thesaurus, open to a page that has the word imagination at the top. There is a little Sony television to the right of the desk, and 5 3-ring notebooks containing Lucas's notes and sketches for the entire Star Wars epic, past, present, and future. There is also a picture of Marcia and the baby. When he is writing, Lucas spends about 8 hours a day in his treehouse, with a short break for lunch. "If I spend 8 hours writing," he says, "I probably spend 3 hours writing and the rest of the time thinking." Lucas's rough draft had the most important parts of the story occur on Had Abaddon, capital of the Galactic Empire, a planet covered in cities and enshrouded in smog. This is the planet that would eventually become Coruscant in the prequel trilogy. There are also 2 Death Stars under construction instead of merely 1, orbiting Had Abaddon's green moon, which is being harvested as a sanctuary for the overpopulated metropolis. In the opening scene, Leia and a platoon of rebel troops, under the guise of Imperial soldiers, sneak into the orbiting green moon, where they plan to then assault the Imperial capital in a final battle to destroy the Empire. Meanwhile, Darth Vader and Moff Gergerod, similar to the Imperial bureaucrat Moff Tarkin in the original film, land on Had Abaddon and meet with the Emperor, who is finally revealed. In order to reach him, they must first go to his grand palace and then travel many miles underground. The Emperor dwells in the very bowels of the planet, so deep underground that his throne sits atop a lake of lava, a truly satanic image. Vader and Gergerod kneel before the Emperor, who tells Vader that his powers have gotten weak and that Luke has grown in power and must be destroyed. Vader tries to disagree, but is choked through the Force. Luke is the Emperor's to destroy, and he orders Vader away. Once gone, the Emperor tells Gergerod to watch Vader, and that Luke will not be destroyed, but instead turned into his new apprentice. This then becomes the crux of the film. Gergerod and the Emperor compete with Vader for Luke. The Emperor wants Luke to kill Vader and rule with him, while Vader wants Luke to kill the Emperor and rule with him. Unlike what is seen in Empire Strikes Back, where Vader was still portrayed as a 2-dimensional evildoer, he is now implied to have some feelings for his son, and expresses concern that Luke may be in danger from the Emperor. The start of Vader's humanization thus begins, and the true villain of the film becomes the Emperor. On Tatooine, Luke is dreaming of Vader in the dark side. Yoda and Ben are also in the dream, and Luke criticizes Ben for not telling him the truth about Vader. Yoda explains that soon he will join Ben in the Netherworld, and will therefore be stronger and able to help Luke in his destiny with the Emperor. Luke and Lando then free Han Solo from Jabba's palace, in a sequence similar to that of the finished film. They all leave on board the Falcon, where Luke has another dream. Yoda tells Luke that he must destroy Vader, but Luke doesn't think he can do it. Obi-Wan then appears and reveals that Luke has a sister. Luke searches his feelings and knows that it is Leia. The Falcon then travels to the Rebel base, where the attack is planned. Meanwhile, on the Green Moon, Leia meets the Ewoks, short, furry creatures with big yellow eyes, in a sequence similar to the final film. Luke has a vision that Leia will be in danger, and that the Rebel attack on Had Abaddon will fail. Luke decides to help her, and so now he must face Vader, whether he is ready or not. Luke travels with the Millennium Falcon to the Green Moon, but they are met with an ambush. Han, Chewie, and the robots escape, but Luke climbs a tree and hides. After convincing from the spirit of Ben Kenobi, he surrenders to the Imperials with the intention of finally confronting Vader. Luke is to be taken to the Emperor on Had Abaddon, but Vader instead wants Luke to be brought to him. General Veers, loyal to Vader, delivers Luke to Vader's Star Destroyer, where Vader tempts Luke to join the dark side. Luke refuses, and Vader tells him that he is not strong enough to destroy the Emperor. Moff Gergerod suddenly enters, enraged that Vader has taken Luke for himself. Vader grabs him by the throat and kills him, and then takes Luke to see the Emperor. The Ewoks help the rebels fight on the Green Moon, using gun emplacements to blow up the communications disk on Hadd Abaddon. The rebel fleet then comes out of hyperspace, and the space battle occurs. As Vader is escorting Luke to the Emperor's throne room on Hadd Abaddon, Obi-Wan's ghost appears. He tells Vader he is there to save him, that the Emperor wants to destroy him. He tells Vader that if he turns to the good side, he will pass through the netherworld when he dies, and Obi-Wan will rescue him before he becomes one with the Force, so that he will retain his identity. Vader refuses and brings Luke to the Emperor's lava lair. Once there, Luke refuses to kneel before him, and the Emperor says that he will not be destroyed by Luke. Obi-Wan suddenly appears, defying the Emperor, followed by Yoda, and the Emperor begins to panic. He orders Vader to destroy Luke, and father and son begin to fight, jumping from rock to rock over a river of lava. Luke eventually cuts off Vader's arm, and the Emperor orders Luke to finish him off. Vader begs Luke to kill him, but Luke refuses and tosses aside his lightsaber. The Emperor begins to shoot lightning bolts at Luke, but he is protected by an invisible shield. Wherever the lightning strikes him, the images of Obi-Wan and Yoda appear, but Luke soon collapses under the strain. Suddenly, Vader charges the Emperor, grabbing him, and they both fall into the lake of lava. As the rebels celebrate their victory, Luke tells Leia that she is his sister. Obi-Wan then appears in flesh and blood, followed by Yoda, and finally, the elderly Anakin Skywalker. The script has the same basic plot as the actual movie, but a number of significant variances are obvious. The driving force of the script, however, is Vader and his relationship to Luke. Perhaps more so than even the final film, Vader is presented as a character with his own struggles. Just as Luke struggles with Vader and the Emperor, a parallel subplot is created in which Vader struggles with Luke and the Emperor. We view Luke's temptation from both sides. Vader himself experiences a temptation, this time in the form of Luke and Obi-Wan, who beckon him to become good again. However, he nonetheless remains somewhat unemotional about the matter. His mission to save Luke is not done out of overridingly compassionate means, but rather more for practical means, to keep Luke as his own apprentice and rule together, not wildly different from the finale of Empire Strikes Back. His ultimate sacrifice in killing the Emperor comes across as being done to prevent his prize from falling into his rival's hands, and he ends up, unintentionally it seems, tumbling into the lava with him. Nevertheless, the first steps towards humanizing Vader had occurred, and as the audience views his struggle to claim Luke while competing with the Emperor, he becomes a somewhat sympathetic character, despite the fact that his intentions are at odds with our hero, Luke. His character had taken strides in development, compared to what was seen in any of the previous films, where he was still the role of menacing villain. The first rough draft depicted him as trying to save Luke to overthrow the Emperor, but the first hints of a more humanized Vader emerged, with a moment where he is offered a chance of redemption in returning to the light side. With each subsequent draft, this seed would be magnified and more depth given to Vader and Luke's relationship, until we arrive at the final draft, where Vader saves his son out of pure compassion and finally makes amends. A Family Affair. Lucas had a lot of issues to deal with in crafting Revenge of the Jedi. The other he had made mention of in the second film is the most notorious of the loose ends he had to tie up. Lucas would have probably liked to not deal with the issue at all, but viewers eagerly looked forward to the reveal of whom this person could be. However, with the sequel trilogy abandoned, Lucas was now forced to address this issue and resolve who this person was. The most obvious solution was to make the character another Jedi whom had survived the Great Jedi Purge, similar to Yoda and Obi-Wan. However, arbitrarily introducing another character to satisfy this plot point was not very practical from a storytelling point of view. And with another Jedi on the side of the rebels, Luke's character would be significantly diminished. With no room to satisfyingly introduce a plausible new character, Lucas felt it best to make this character into one of the pre-existing ones. But who would it be? Han, perhaps? He was a character who acted